In association with iFanboy, welcome again to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. This is John Suntress. It's time to talk to Rick Remender, and not only because his Uncanny X-Force is kicking ass with a debut first issue that's sold out, but also Rick is in the midst of wrapping up his Punisher run. The controversial run that included Frankencastle ends with a very traditional Punisher story called In the Blood. And if you really look at all the story arcs that Rick's been doing on the Punisher, he's the first to explain how it all fits together. Rick took some chances and had some hits and misses at Marvel with Uncanny X-Force and Frankencastle's controversial acceptance to the short-lived Dr. Voodoo series of last year. Rick and I talk about his successes and failures both at Marvel and DC and what it means for the future. That's all coming up in this episode of Word Balloon. Today it's brought to you by InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com, where as always you get a wide selection of trade paperbacks, hardbacks, essentials, absolute editions, omnibus editions, and more, with discounts of 38 to 42% off the standard retail price. And Rick Remender is well represented at InStockTrades.com. You may want to spend a lot of money. In fact, as always, at InStockTrades.com, when you spend $50 or more, you get free shipping. Lots of great product at InStockTrades.com with the name Rick Remender on it, including his Fear Agent books. We talk about Fear Agent. It's wrapping up. And you can catch up with Fear Agent at 42% off the standard retail price when you buy trades at InStockTrades.com. Volume 2 of Fear Agent, My War, the standard retail price is $14.95. It's just $8.67 at InStockTrades.com. Same with the last Fear Agent arc, Eye Against Eye. The standard retail price is $14.95, $8.67 at InStockTrades.com. Another book we'll be talking about today, available at InStockTrades.com from Rick, The Last Days of American Crime. The standard retail price is $14.95. You can do better at InStockTrades.com, $11.21. If you didn't have the chance to read Rick's Dr. Voodoo, the trade paperback is available. The standard retail price, $16.99. InStockTrades.com has it for $10.53. You'll find tons of Rick's Punisher work as well from Marvel at InStockTrades.com again, with 38% off the standard retail price. For all the details, check out their website, InStockTrades.com. Now, before we get started with the comic book talk, we start our discussion with Rick talking about his work in computer games. He's got a long history in the world of computer games, and a brand new game is coming out in February called Bulletstorm. Tell me about Bulletstorm.
It's sort of Fear Agent meets Blackheart Billy meets Gears of War. The production company, Epic, and their studio People Can Fly, who are making the game, are all big fans of both Blackheart Billy and Fear Agent. So they flew me out to Poland, where the studio is, and they wanted something. They had some basic ideas. They knew that they had the basic setup for the planet that you would crash on, because that's what happens in pulp science fiction. You're crashing again.
Right.
That's what happens. The game itself it's about a bunch of, you know, they had some basic ideas they wanted to keep, and that was they wanted some sort of a militaristic theme. They wanted the villain to be just the general. They wanted it to feel sort of like Duke Nukem and very over the top and sort of leaning into the archetypes and tropes that the genre traditionally, you know, has. And as an assignment, it was a pretty good one in terms of, like, I like writing that stuff. You know, big, over-the-top, insane pulp science fiction is something that is not a hard, it's not a hard sell for me. I went down to Poland and I spent about 7 or 8 days there with the director and the producer, and we banged out a nice outline, and the basic premise is about a band of ex and black ops soldiers who are betrayed by their general, and, like, again, understanding that this is all, we're well aware of the stereotype that we're leaning into here, but then they become space pirates, which is where it gets fun, and then these guys, as they're space pirates, end up having an adventure where they crash on this Dubai-like planet that's inhabited by mutated road warrior gangs and living, you know, Venus flytrap plants that want to eat you and giant monsters. And at that point, it was just a matter of, you know, shaking the Saturday morning cartoon bank in your head and seeing what fell to the ground.
That's perfect. Well, that's your milieu, so that's wonderful.
Indeed.
That's great, man. And I remember you telling me that you'd been going to Poland for the super secret project.
Yeah, that was, I guess, about a year ago. And, I'm still... still doing X, Y, and Z on that. I'm going out to L.A. next week. I guess I'm going to do some. They wanted to film me for some commercial stuff. Yeah, and it's, you know, this all comes out of, you know, it's sort of my side career. I'm you know, I was one of the writers on Dead Space, which is EA's big franchise, and now this. And so it's great. You know, how can you complain about sitting around figuring out what kind of super cool, you know, scenarios to cook up that people will play through in a video game?
Now, do you, when you're, like, working out the story and stuff like that, are they providing you with full character, or are you, because you're an artist as well, have you gotten involved with character design?
Not design. You know, I definitely try and have a say, but it, my aesthetic might not be, like, modern, marketable. I don't know. Like, I want to make everything, like, I like kind of kitschy aesthetic and then modern storytelling, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that might not necessarily, that's probably not the gaming market. So in terms of the design of things, I haven't really been involved. But the characters themselves and the world and the story, I mean, yeah, it's all me. And obviously, you know, I wrote, good Lord, I mean, I wrote, it's a 4 or 5 hour game. And, you know, it's dialogue throughout. They wanted it to feel like a comic book. They wanted, and they're all big comic guys.
Cool.
Good comic guys, you know, like they read all kinds of comics. And so they really wanted the game to feel like an insane comic book that was still, again, you know, the same sensibility of a lot of my work where it's big and insane on the top, but underneath there's real foundation and real character building and real heart and maybe even romance and things. So then that was what we focused on. And that's my favorite thing to do, because you're sort of unhindered in terms of the big insanity that you can put your characters up against, or what they, you know, the visual things that they're going to be, in, you know, coming across and enduring in terms of antagonists. But then underneath that, people are always very shocked, you know, and they let me, like, in terms of Blackheart Billy, that was something that they wanted me the tone of that was something they wanted. The sense of humor was something that they wanted to see sort of emulated in the game, which is a blast for me. And there's nothing more fun in terms of, like, you know, that's one of one of my war chests is I like to write sort of absurdist humor, and that's
absolutely
what they wanted with science fiction. So off I went, and which is, you know, I've also had recently. An editor I've enjoyed working with recently, Steve Wacker at Marvel, has hired me to write a "What If Deadpool Became Venom" short story, which, being collected in January, I believe. But that's another opportunity where it was like it's like writing Blackheart Billy or any of my, you know, older humor stuff again, and it's nice to break out the goofy absurdist and get into that stuff. So I've been able to scratch that itch a little bit this year.
Now, Bulletstorm comes out in February, you said?
Yeah, it does.
Very cool. And what is the next step with you in Dead Space? Are you going to continue writing for that?
No. I wrote on the first one. It was Warren Ellis who did the first the creation stuff, and then I came in and did the first 6 or 7 drafts of the entire thing, and then Anthony Johnston came in and did the next couple polishes to finish it off. So
cool.
That was a nice group of guys to be surrounded with.
Hell yeah.
The creative process, you know. So that we did the first one. I think Anthony might be involved in the second. I'm not sure, but I don't think I know Warren's not, and I wasn't.
Very cool, man. Well, and, you know, I know you've had a long history in games as well. I remember us talking about your work on one of the Bond games, and that you got to write dialogue for Connery and people like that.
Yeah, that was terrific.
Is there news on who's, like, are there going to be any famous voices in Bulletstorm? I know some, it's funny, a couple of our voiceover people that I work with at my radio station do voices, especially the girls, and one was even Spider-Woman in one of the Ultimate games for Marvel.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was kind of neat.
I would imagine that that would be another sort of, you know, like as a writer, I you know, comic books, naturally, video games are not a big stretch. And so I guess in radio, you're a voice actor, basically.
Right.
Why not hop in and do some character work? Yeah. The main guy that they've got is Steve Bloom. I don't know if you know who Steve is, but it was pretty... odd that they selected him, and he's terrific. Not odd in that he's not good for the role, but one of the games that I've I play online with a bunch of other writers and friends is the Call of Duty zombie game, and Steve Bloom does the main voice for the guy in that. And so when they hired him, I got to listen to him read my ridiculous lines. And
excellent, man. Let's shuffle into the comic book world.
Let's shuffle in.
Now, I want to start with Uncanny X-Force, because first of all, congratulations. I'm glad the first issue sold out. Big hit.
Yeah, it's terrific. And people seem to like it. It's been nice.
And I am like the out-of-towner who comes to the Broadway play, and it's like, all right, now this is the one I heard about. Because, you know, my X-Men knowledge is like, you know, next to nil, other than the...
Oh,
yeah, no, other than the original five. I'm like kind of a knucklehead. But you told me, too. Now, I saw you in the summer. I saw you in San Diego. And you're like, well, that's perfect, because this is the book for the non-X-Men person to jump in.
We've really tried to make it that in anyway.
Well, that's good. No, honestly, and I will tell you what I know, and I'll ask you questions, because I have to admit that I'm a little puzzled, and I'm sure there are a million more X-Men fans than me, and I know a lot of the Word Balloon listeners get mad that I don't talk more about the X-Men, and will be saying, idiot, I can't believe you don't know who the fuck that is.
Stupid John, I hate him.
Exactly.
And then they're going to blow up their computers and riot in the streets and piss on their grandmother. Fire. Blood.
Pretty much. All right, well, this is what I'm figuring. Okay. So Psylocke is helping Angel keep the Archangel persona in check.
Yep.
And this is Warren's team?
It's Warren and Logan.
Right.
I liked the idea when I was cooking that up that there wasn't just going to be one captain who's in charge of, now we're going to kill this person. It seemed like the kind of thing that's such an important choice, especially for a band of, like, real heroes. That they're in such desperate straits that they can't afford to have the mutant population sort of caught by surprise and hit anymore, that they have to go out and preemptively do these things. And so the idea was that Warren and Logan both sort of choose people to join the team, and they also both sort of collaborate in terms of discussing how they're going to take on their targets and what target they're going to take on and if they're deserving of the wrath of X-Force.
Was there a setup before this in one of the other books to, you know, did Scott go to Warren and Logan, or is this all presupposed in what we read in the first issue?
No. The setup was, you know, in the last one, was Scott recognizes a storm coming and that they couldn't sit around and be a family of happy people anymore. This was dark business, and that he called in Wolverine. So Scott and Wolverine made all the calls, basically. But it was Scott playing general and Wolverine playing field marshal. And so this is Scott put the kibosh on it. Scott saw that the big threat was taken care of, and that, you know, things are evening out, and they don't need to resort to these sorts of methods. And so Scott says, "Kind of no more X-Force," and then, you know, Logan and Warren have a conversation and say, Scott, it's, you know, let's Scott think that that's the case, but we know different. And so they choose, you know, they agree on Betsy, and then Logan chooses Phantom X to join. Warren chooses Deadpool, and Deadpool's sort of he's out always hunting down for leads on threats. He's recon, basically.
Yeah.
Deadpool out there reconning for threats and things on the Worthington payroll. And then the rest of the team sort of on call to come up to Cavern X, and you know, the new base. We'll see a lot more of that in issue two. And I think a lot of the time you got Warren and Betsy kind of hanging out there together, and they're all like in love and stuff.
Yeah, nice scene, exactly. Nice bedroom scene. Now who does Logan recruit? Because honestly, now here's an X-Man. I have no idea who the hell he is. Help me out.
Well, Phantom X is
Phantom X.
Who was also from the Weapon Plus program.
Okay.
Which is, you know, Weapon X is a part of that. And he was created in The World, which is part of the Grant Morrison stuff, which, if you haven't read, is terrific fun and big imagination and really spot-on character work. I recommend it.
Okay.
So Phantom X is a Grant Morrison. He was born out of that era of the book. And he's just this terrific, like, he was created to be a palatable, sort of marketable sentinel, and he's a contrivance of himself, which is terrific. Like, he was created to be this, like a Wolverine, like this guy who everybody's like, oh, isn't he the coolest guy ever? You know, he's all about Danger Diabolique, and he's all international jewel thief, and he's got his UFO that he, you know, keeps in his stomach. It's, you know, his EPA
really?
Is UFO that's also his nervous system. And it's, you know, it's,
oh, that's
it's,
pretty cool.
It's just one, and his power, he's an illusionist of sorts, which at first you hear, like, illusionist, you know.
Doug Henning.
You're right, you know, like, the world of illusion. But the misdirection power he has, where you think you're looking at something, and you're, you know, next thing you know, he's pulled this on Jean Grey and Professor X a lot, and the Grant Morrison stuff. And the more I got into it and started, you know, thinking about the possibilities, it's terrific. I mean, I use it a lot in the first arc, and for a lot of fun in a lot of fun ways, because you can do a lot of things that keep the reader going, like, oh my God, did that just happen, or was that Phantom X using his powers? And that's always a lot of fun. And so he's a guy who was born, created in the world to be a sentinel, to go out and kill mutants, and to be a sort of Saturday morning cartoon. You know, they're going to make action figures, and so everybody sort of would be okay with it. But he decided not to. He decided, and we deal with that starting in the fifth issue of X-Force. It's been touched upon, but never really explored, and so I'm digging into that. He was created for this purpose, and he didn't ever take up arms and go out and kill mutants. In fact, what he did was to seek out their aid, and then eventually he knew all the secrets of the Weapon X and the Weapon Plus program, and so he actually took Wolverine to the world, which is this giant dome where time can be controlled and move forward and backward to hyper-evolve things.
Okay.
It's craziness. It's so much fun, too. I mean, I'm using the world a lot in the upcoming story arcs. But then the bottom line is that he used what he knew to help a fellow sort of tampering victim in Wolverine, and sort of filled in a lot of blanks about Wolverine's past for him by opening up the world and showing him some of the things about his history that he didn't know. He's just, you know, international jewel thief with a, he's sort of Danger Diabolique-esque.
Yes, well, I can tell from the costume, absolutely, as soon as you said that. I'm like, all right, yeah, I get that. All right, that sounds cool. All right, now, help me out with the Purple Kid. Because honestly, I don't know. I'm sure that's like, you know, a DC fan looking at the Joker and, you know, say, yeah, okay, how about the clown? What's the deal?
Why is that smiling man causing the trouble for the bat black guy to shoot with the yellow chest?
Because obviously, I'm sure everyone just, you know, wet their pants when they saw the kid. And I'm sure that made a lot of sense to people. But help me. Who's the kid?
Apocalypse is... Okay. A big ex-villain who rears his ugly head every couple, 4 or 5 years. And
was he last killed? Had he been killed recently?
No, he was taken away by the Celestials. You know, he's powered by Celestial technology because he's basically an indentured servant. Not an indentured servant, but he sold his soul, basically, to them.
Okay.
And then also we've seen him in various futures. And then, of course, there's a dimension where...
the Age of Apocalypse.
That was created out of the 616. And pardon me for getting out my nerd glasses.
No, this is what I'm asking for, sir.
This is what I do for a living now. So the Apocalypse Legion, Charles Xavier's son, wanted to make him happy. And he went back in time to kill Magneto. Instead, he went back in time and Xavier jumped in the way and he killed Xavier. So Legion went back in time, killed his dad, the universe cracks open, and everything moves forward from that point. And without Xavier to start the X-Men, Magneto gives it a run, but of course his methodology and his ideology is different. Apocalypse, through Magneto's weakness, is offered a chance to take over the world, and he does. So they created this entire Age of Apocalypse,
right.
Which was
okay.
A lot of fun, a big reimagining of the entire Marvel Universe and all of the X characters, and some really, really gorgeous new character designs. And
is this Storm Vampire and Wolverine with the eye patch and everything? Is it that kind of cats and dogs living together kind of?
Cats and dogs living together. I think this was Wolverine, like one hand had been cut off.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
See, and again, I forgive me, kids. I apologize. That's my blind spot. So yes, all right. As soon as you said Apocalypse, I'm like, all right, Age of Apocalypse.
You know, my mom does giggle because basically from 1984 to 1999, I read the X-Men books like a crazy person.
Sure.
And Now I finally get some payback for it. You know, I'd really have to be on this book for like 5 years to make enough money to get paid back for all the cash I dumped into this knowledge, this encyclopedia. But at least it's come full circle. But anyway, so Apocalypse is basically he's a big fan of Flash Darwinianism. He believes that the human race's time has come. The mutant race is obviously the successor and should take over, and so he's putting boot down and figuring out ways to help with that. He's a survival of the fittest guy. He wants, you know, and because of that, he believes that the mutants need to just wipe out the humans and be done with it so that there's no more threat to their natural evolution. There's been so many different incarnations of this guy and what he's done that he has a society of followers. He was the first mutant. He was born back in, 2000, B.C.
Gotcha.
And he was a slave, and he ended up, saving his people from pharaohs and rising up and blah, blah, blah. So having been around as long as he has, he's got an entire cult of ancestors and a cult of followers, and that's called the Akaba Society. So the Akaba Society don't know where he's gone, he's basically dead. The Celestials took him off and took a dump on his head or whatever they did to him. It was just, so much had gone on. They basically hit the reset button and they had one chance to do this, to grab his essence, his consciousness, which was, some of it was in Scott Summers. It just had just gone. He'd been everywhere and touched everything. And so they hit the reset button, sucked everything back into resurrecting him, but he comes back as a kid. He doesn't come back as, big...
Right.
Big, 6,000-year-old, guy in adorned in celestial kick-your-ass armor. He comes back as, 8-year-old boy or whatever,
Yeah, baby Hitler. So this is baby Hitler, essentially.
This is the baby Hitler quandary.
Okay.
Yeah.
And he doesn't know that he was this... great thing.
That's the fun thing, he's sort of a blank slate. His
okay.
Consciousness is still in there. He's still the same person. If you were a telepath, Glaven, and you were to read his mind, you would find the same essence, the same quote-unquote soul, whatever it is, but it's not. He doesn't have the same, So they're training him. They're sort of teaching him and getting him up to speed on who he is and how important he is and what his, objective is. And during this, of course, now, Wade, Deadpool, who is Warren's...
frontman. His ranger.
Right. He's out there doing the sniffing around, and he discovers that these guys are back in action. He doesn't know and doesn't have any idea. He sees somebody being resurrected, and he sees what they're up to, and he sees a few things. But he doesn't know that it's a kid. And so I think that when he comes back to the team and tells them Apocalypse is back, they all think they're going in for the big fight that we've seen, 6 or 7 times in the past 20 years. But they're not. There's a nice twist, actually, and he's a kid.
Sure. Now, and also Archangel, and help me out if I'm correct, his dark side, is it tied to Apocalypse in being
it
Archangel?
Is. Right, and that's the other.
He was one of the four horsemen for Apocalypse?
He was one of the first four horsemen.
See, all right. See, I know a little bit. All right.
Yeah, and he's got a thing called death inside of him, and death is, I'm thinking of it in terms of, it's an heir apparent, it's a seed, it's sort of like, it's sort of his next, Apocalypse's next of kin. And he's planted it in Wolverine and Gambit and a bunch of other people, but it never took root. I think of the human psyche as soil in terms of the death seed. And it took root in Warren, and it grew, and Apocalypse always knew it would. There's plenty of continuity to back this up, so I'm, ready to fist fight anybody who calls me out on it.
All right.
Well, first of all, during the beginning of Inferno, because I turned into Charles Nelson Reilly when I talk X-Men continuity. or Peter Lynn, hello, Peter Marshall.
Paul Lynn.
Yeah.
I understand.
Anyway,
it's all right. You're allowed, man.
So he planted, death grows in the person it's planted in, but it's also, a product of the soil it's grown in. So what Warren's dealing with is death is like his conjoined twin, it's something that grew inside of his psyche and now lives in his head. And if Betsy were to remove it, then it would shatter his mind.
Sure.
It's just the roots are grown in too deeply. So it's one of these situations where Betsy is, what she's forced to do is put a barrier in there and stick around and make sure that Archangel can't, you know, go past a certain point and take over Warren. And that's her role. And that's something that's been sort of meandering and unexplained for a long time, is how this works. And it was very important to me and Axel and Jody, the editors, that this first issue address exactly how Warren it works, exactly what's going on with Warren and his relationship with Betsy, and how this is all connected. And, you know, again, with an X-Men book and being so aware of continuity, it was very important to me to not rely on that and to go into this knowing that, like, a lot of people are going to try this, and if I don't define each one of these characters in the first issue, as well as do it in a way that doesn't feel like exposition, that keeps the book moving and mm-hmm. exciting visually, then I've failed. And it took me, you know, I probably spent going back and forth with the editors, you know, 4 or 5 weeks on that one issue to make sure that all of those things were addressed. And so that's the basic setup stuff. Hopefully people, you know, walk away from it. And I haven't had a lot of, like, what the hell happened? So I think we did a good job of defining who this cast is in the first issue.
Very cool. Well, no, honestly, I've heard nothing but great things, and I was pleased to read that it sold out. So, you know, this is a great start. And also, I can't help but notice that this team, much like the Secret Avengers, being kind of the, you know, clandestine side of the X-Men and stuff, I can only imagine that down the road we could maybe see a Secret Avenger Uncanny X-Force crossover of some sort, I would think.
You would think. You know, it was something that, Ed and I passed a few emails back and forth, and who knows? I think that the trouble comes down to, you know, if anybody finds out that the X-Men have a covert team of assassins going out and murdering people, humanity is going to want to burn the mutants back down to the ground. You know, it's a big deal. Like, if that was on the front page of, you know, Frontline or whatever the Daily Bugle is now, that's going to cause big trouble. That's, you know, Wolverine runs Mutant Hit Squad. You know, like, guess who's losing his Avengers membership?
Right, and also Steve obviously kind of sticking his neck out for the mutants and everything, and
it would be bad, it wouldn't be good. So anytime I start thinking about their interconnectivity of the Marvel Universe, that point, you know, kind of pops in my head, and I remember they can't really come into contact with anybody in these gray and black suits. You know, they're going to have to be very careful, which adds the stealthy element, adds a lot of fun to the book. You know, they've got their own base, and they've got their own transportation, and it's just these five characters right now, and it's all a secret, you know, and that sort of binds them as a family as well.
That's what I was going to say. This is a lean team, and outside of Wolverine, are they involved in any other X groups?
Deadpool is not.
Right,
the
obviously.
The others are part of the rotating cast in Uncanny, so we'll see.
Okay.
They still serve on the Sunny team, and they still go to Utopia and hang out with the other mutants and high-five and play basketball, and then, you know, do their business, and then when the occasion calls for an assassination, and Deadpool's out there sniffing around, when he finds things that are big enough, then he basically calls the rest of the team and says, "Hey, look what I found. What do you want to do?" And if it's, you know, worthy, they go out and try and stomp it out.
Attaboy. All right, very cool, excellent, man. Well, very nice start, and best wishes as it continues.
Yeah, it was terrific. I mean, not just the sellout, but to, you know, obviously, you know, when you we hit you know, the number one book for the month last month.
Yeah,
and
huge.
I take full credit for that.
Well, no, I was going
to
say,
I want to go on record as saying that has nothing to do with Wolverine or Deadpool or Marvel's promotional efforts or the fact it's a new X-Men number one. It's completely me that people have all of a sudden decided they needed 100,000 copies of everything I write.
So yeah, and
everything I write to sell 100,000 copies.
And Jerome's art really sucks, so sorry.
And Jerome is nothing.
He really.
In white coloring,
dude,
nothing.
Pitching underhand, clearly.
The editorial team, nothing.
Once again, yes. No, honestly, and kudos to Jerome, whose art continues to dazzle. And
yeah, he's
it's
crazy good. It's such a treat.
Like, no, he just keeps getting better and better, and I am blown away with how, I mean, it really is a beautiful book.
It is. It's been great to you know, Jerome and I've been working together for 5 years now, and it's been a treat watching him progress and grow and sort of, you know, as our vocabulary, as our shorthand becomes sort of a scientific process, it's a well-oiled machine. We geek out pretty good together.
Awesome, man. Well, and pivoting to the Punisher book, because I loved Frankencastle, but I am glad to see that. Really, I think you've shown, Rick, that you can pretty much write any kind of Punisher story you want to. And I mean that sincerely, because I loved Frankencastle. I loved what happened when you and Matt were first on the book together. And I think you've handled each change in the Marvel backdrop admirably and been able to pivot with the Punisher and put him in the next position of, okay, we're fighting Skrulls. This is what we're going to do. Oh, Norman's the target in the hood. Fine. This is how I'm going to present it. And I loved Frankencastle. I thought it was a lot of fun detour. But in a lot of ways, you're going back to what you were doing right before Frankencastle. And, he's facing Microchip and Jigsaw again.
Right.
In a good way.
Yeah, and it was, this is all part of, this is the end of it for me. This was all part of one big outline that I wrote up. And I tend to do these giant outlines when I start books where I jot down all these ideas and I sort of start stringing them together and seeing how I can naturally, like, turn it into a big story, and it's nice to get to the end of it. I did the same thing with Fear Agent. I wrote, it's like you can write an 8-page document that turns out to take you, 4 years to complete. That's the case with a lot of things I've done. Having written the story out, obviously by the time I wrote the second issue, and I knew I basically put Henry in there because I had this big Jigsaw story that was still brewing in my head from what Matt and I had done with Stuart Clark and turning him into Jigsaw 2 and the stuff that we did in War Journal. And it's just wild how long it takes, like 24 issues of comic book, in terms of outline, it's nothing, you're like, oh, okay, and then I'm going to give, Jigsaw's kid and blah, 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 and then Frank's going to die and he's going to, get all patched up and have the bloodstone, blah, 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 and you recognize in, 3, 4, 5 pages, you've written yourself a couple of years worth of work. It's sort of the Frankencastle stuff was all born of the natural sort of instinct that Frank had to die, and Frank had to take a hit. And I didn't even want to for a while, it was, someone was like, oh, it was a marketing ploy. I'm like, it really wasn't. I love Frank, and I wanted him to be a big player and succeed. I wanted Frank to carry Norman Osborn's head out into the street and hold it up and everybody cheer Frank Castle. But no way I tried to write Frank going out and killing a Dark Avenger or taking a big hit on a bunch of Thunderbolts. No way I wrote it felt like it just didn't work. It just didn't feel right. And so I at the very beginning of this, I pitched it a few different ways, whoever Venom is, Frank will kill. And it's like, Frank probably couldn't do that. not to undermine the guy. I'm sure it was enough planning. But for me, for my nerd encyclopedia, when I think about who Frank is, what he's done, and again, having read Punisher comics for 20 years, when you get the Dungeons and Dragons manual out and you really go over the stats, Frank isn't going to kill Venom. He's just not. It's just probably not going to happen. And if he's up against Venom, all of Hammer, the other Thunderbolts, Dark Avengers, and he was up against everybody. And so the more we beat it up, the more it was clear he had to die. And that derailed a lot of stuff that was taking place in the first two trades. And all the things that had been set up there did get sort of backseated while the second arc was the Frankencastle stuff. So if the first arc is Frank taking a shot on Norman and then, going up against the Hood, who resurrects his family, and then Frank puts his family right back into the ground, then that's the end of the first act, leading into the second act, where Frank is devastated and destroyed, and he's a physical manifestation of the terrible torn-up monster that he is inside now, and dealing with the ramifications of having killed his own family for whatever reason. Now that that's all wrapped up and we've gone through that second act, now we've got the third act, which is in the blood, and that's I hope people buy it because I'm so proud of the work. And Roland Boschi is like, good Lord, he's like Goran Parlov meets Mike Mignola, I mean, he's just so good. And you know, there's Mazzucchelli in there, There's just nothing but each issue is just better and better. I've been begging Marvel to please find me something else to do with Roland. And the story itself I'm biased, but it is like this thing that's been gestating and brewing in my head now for 2.5 years, and to finally get to tell what I hope will be the ultimate big gangbang of all of the people Frank's ever had association with in terms of his assistants: Microchip, Stuart Clark, Henry Russo, and Billy Russo, behind it all, sort of orchestrating one last big, you know, attack on Frank. And it's not the kind of attack you'll think, you know. Like, there's a leather-clad burn victim, a very, very attractive woman who Frank thinks he knows who is.
Yes.
Is, and it's going to be a big, big, big ugly situation for Frank. It'll make Frank and Castle pale by comparison.
Excellent. Well, that's the thing, and I would say, because I saw some detractors during Frankencastle, like, all right, when's he going to get back to crime and everything? It's like, here it is, kids. And as you say, even more so because he's facing Jigsaw and going through, as you say, the devolution of his assistants. And you've got the extreme version of Microchip. You see what's happening with Stuart. And of course, he even sees it in this first chapter, the weaknesses in Henry, and wonders, how long am I going to be able to rely on Henry before the worst happens? And of course, we see what happens at the end of the first issue. So, no, I think, as you say, a great artist to match up with, and I think it looks great. It has that Marvel universe on the one hand, but it's definitely a Punisher book that leans towards the Max Punisher in terms of it just being hard, straight-up crime. And I think it's, you know, again, it's what people, if you've been missing that element in the Punisher, it's back. And it's it's a story that I hope they collect all 24. I hope when the time comes, your entire Punisher run, because that is this epic story that you've been able to tell for a couple of years now.
Yeah, and it's been great. They've been really supportive in letting me do it in the way I initially saw it too. And I know they're doing a big Frankencastle omnibus, and that's going to be pretty fat. You know, that'll be 10, 12 issues. So I guess that's not too fat. I think about it. Oh, there's also the Dark Wolverine issues, but and I think that the obviously I'd love to see an omnibus like they did with Jason Aaron's Ghost Rider.
Right, exactly. That's what I was thinking.
We'll see. You know, I know that the Frankencastle omnibus is selling incredibly well, and that people are responding to it, and a lot of people were waiting until it was collected. So they didn't do a soft cover of any of the Frankencastle stuff. They were waiting until it was beginning, middle, and end. You know, the whole chapter and one big thing, one big hardcover omnibus is coming out, I think, December 1st. So hopefully people will pick it up and, you know, we can see a collection of the rest of it. I couldn't be more proud of it. And I recognize that there's going to be people who can't deal with anything that changes the familiarity of how things are in their minds in terms of characters. And I don't begrudge them that at all. I haven't had anybody present me with an argument that I found compelling in terms of going against Frankencastle, other than they don't like the aesthetic. Frank Castle doesn't, this doesn't happen to him. Like, it
right.
did happen to him. It happens to all kinds of people. Like, you know who the Reavers are? The Reavers are also people who got cut to pieces by Wolverine, and then they got turned into cyborgs that looked a lot like Frankencastle. You know, like, it actually happens a lot in the Marvel Universe. That's the problem. You know, like, with your logic is that, you know, well, he's a street character. I'm like, yeah, well, the streets are connected to the buildings are connected to the streets, connected to the gutters, you know, like, it doesn't matter. You're running around Craziesville, and the crazy's going to hit you.
Well,
but it is nice. It's a nice palate cleanser in terms of people who might not have liked that for the aesthetic reasons or just having some gut reaction to things changing. But here you've got the third act. If you liked the first two, even if you didn't, you know, I've worked hard to make sure you can walk in the blood and get a self-contained story as well.
Yes, I definitely. And also, based on what I saw in Frankencastle, I want you to play more with the Marvel Monsters, and especially with guys like Dan Brereton and Tony when they have the time. But, you know, and we talked about Tony a lot at the beginning because we talked about Frankencastle. We didn't get a chance to talk much about Dan Brereton, and I want a Son of Satan series with you and Dan doing it. I think that would be pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, my dream is that, you know, is to get something where maybe, you know, Dan and Tony Moore and I are actually cooking up something else we're working on right now. So he'll be busy for a bit. But, you know, one of the things that's always thrown around is Kip Dan and Roland Boschi in a way where you're telling. I always think about the Legion of Monsters book where the backstory. Every issue has, you know, a lot of backstory that connects to the present. So part of the story is in the 70s and part of the story is in the now. And Dan Brereton does the 70s stuff and Roland Boschi does the now
that's
stuff.
That's terrific.
and you're always building things off of what happened in the 70s and re-examining where they're at now in a way, you know, that would be an ongoing I could write the rest of my life. And I would sink my teeth into that in a way that, you know, it's my dream project. Now, would the market support that? Is the market going to say, Legion of the Monsters ongoing? Yes, Rick Remender. I don't know. I don't know, but I would definitely drop everything that I could to make that book come to reality.
Maybe you guys can figure out a way of doing an occasional miniseries or something like that.
Sure. Yeah. You know? Again, I think it deserves more.
Yeah.
I think it's the back catalog of what Marvel did in the 70s is equivalent to what happened in all of the 60s. It's so much horror stuff. Tomb of Dracula, all of the stuff going on with, you know, Brother Voodoo and they're collected in the Essential Marvel Horror, but Premiere and all this stuff.
Yes, those two volumes are incredible. Not to mention the one that has the Frankenstein stories in it as well.
Frankenstein's got his own Essentials.
Oh, there you go.
Man Thing Essentials and all that. Then there's five. How many volumes of Doctor Strange set that stuff up? I really, in my heart, I had I assumed that Dr. Voodoo was something other people would love the concept of as much as I did.
Me too, man.
And the monsters, and in my mind, I was like, oh, I'm going to build the new Sorcerer Supreme stuff. It's going to tie in with, of all things, the Punisher universe. And then I'm going to get a Legion of Monsters ongoing, and we're going to, like, just make this whole supernatural, badass, crazy world, you know, focus on Werewolf by Night and all these just amazing characters that have been sort of, they just shuffle around the Marvel universe with no purpose. They just show up every once in a while and go, hey, and that was something that, you know. This conversation that, you know, and I know we had this last time was the same thing that Tony Moore and I talked about and Dan Brereton and I got behind. And, you know, I mean, we're just a bunch of guys who like that stuff so much, and it's such a big part of the Marvel Universe that we wanted to make sure. And if you look at the artwork, like, if I failed on every front as a writer on Frankencastle, if I failed on every level, story, structure, character, dialogue, if I just blew out a hunk of shit... It's still worth the money based on what Tony and Dan did in that series.
Here,
and
here.
Roland, you know,
yes.
Roland's work with the Nazi zombies and the flying and the Punisher on the dragon.
Absolutely, yes,
God,
indeed.
So great. And so anyway, it was a treat to get, even if that's as far as it goes. Great. The series of miniseries wouldn't even be enough for me. It needs to have an ongoing, permanent place in the Marvel universe. It needs to feel essential and be tied into everything as well as. This whole amazing dark corner just needs to be explored in a way that I just don't feel like the Midnight Sun stuff of the 90s did it any justice. It just wasn't smart enough, and not to shit on an entire thing that, you know, that a million people worked on, but for how I would like to see it anyway, and you've clearly hit my button here. I want it so bad, John. Make it happen.
If I could clone myself 100,000 times, I would, and we'd all buy it, and we'd all be happy. Because, no, I agree with you, and it was. It was such a great, fertile time in the 70s. It not only was happening in the comics, it was happening in the black and white magazines as well. And, you know, you really, if you don't know about the Marvel past in the monster past of the Bronze Age, you're missing a great chunk of stories and art. That, you know, yeah, I'd like to see you guys all get the chance to bring it up back in full. So whatever we can do. And obviously, you know, there's got to be some editors that are at least willing and, you know, to give you guys the chance to occasionally do it. So hopefully we'll gather enough of an audience to make it happen. Put that next to what Jason did, like you said, with the Ghost Rider stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing. I really think there's potential there.
That's, for me, Legion of Monsters is like it's Son of Satan. It's Dracula. It's Ghost Rider. It's Man-Thing. It's Werewolf by Night. It's
the Mummy, the Living Mummy, Dr. Voodoo.
The Mummy, it's Satana. It's
the Golem, yeah.
It's Manphibian, you know, yeah.
Manphibian.
when you see those characters standing together, and you're like, Ghost Rider, you know, like, it's...
Yeah, I'm with you.
Frankenstein, you know, I just... That, to me, is so... It's so fertile. I want to tell stories with those characters. Like, that's all I want to do.
Well, now with you know, the new Dracula kind of playing around in the X world, is that going to have a chance to figure into X Force in any way?
We've talked about that. You know, like, there's a lot of big stuff on the horizon with that that I'm involved with that I can't talk about yet.
Okay.
And we talked about that. Yeah, I don't know if it will touch X Force because the arc. You know, issue one of X-Force again sets up another 20-issue story.
Okay.
I can't stop myself. Once I get the outline going and I figure out the pieces and all, they all start interconnecting. At this point, the vampire stuff doesn't have any connective tissue. And I've already done the monster stuff in a real big way recently, so I'm trying to lean into some other parts of the Marvel Universe that I'm a big fan of.
Very cool.
Anyway, yeah, so... John, can I get you to hold on for 1 second while
sure,
I cough? I've been sick, and I'm going to put you on mute while I do this.
Hock up away. Attaboy.
Oh, sorry about that.
No. Hey, it does.
Anyway, I'm sure you can edit that nicely.
No problem, man. That's quite all right. I'm trying. Like, is there anything else to say about the Punisher? I mean, you know. We can move on.
I guess that's about it. I mean, I think that when In the Blood is done, if anybody's looking for a big chunk of story, you know, they could hop in on the Jigsaw arc of Punisher War Journal that I wrote with Matt, and they could follow that up through In the Blood and get one big story that I feel is probably pretty satisfying.
Very cool, man. And you know, it was fun reading those essentials too about Jigsaw because. Again, that's part of my blind spot, but it, the one that just came out that had all the Mike Barron and Bill Reinhold stories.
Right.
And that was just really the sweet spot, I think, of a lot of those Punisher stories.
Yeah.
And that's what I think you tapped into when when that Hood story was happening for you as well. So it's good to see that all addressed in this final arc.
Well, thanks. Yeah, I hopefully it'll be satisfying.
Indeed. And moving on to Heath Houston's last journey, I'm sad, but nice going in terms of the run that you guys had, and I'm really glad that Mike Hawthorne has been such an important part of the group now as well, and it's great, man. It's really great, and I love Hillary's backups. Before we get to the main story, I'm so happy that Hillary's been doing these great little 8-pages and stuff. They've been a lot of fun.
Yeah, and you know, we've always made sure that Fear Agent is just as full of comic book as we can make it. You know, we've had those backups since I think issue 5, from just all kinds of really talented people and friends who wanted to contribute, and Hillary has done the most of them, and he's been such a friend. And you know, Hillary is just such I've learned more from Hillary than almost anybody in comics. You know, Hillary and Kieran had a lot to Kieran Dwyer had a lot to do with my learning of the fundamentals early on, and they were both so great and took so much time to I've penciled and they've inked, I've inked and they've penciled. We've all worked together in so many different ways, and I learned so much from those guys that I'm eternally in their debt for the time and energy they've put into helping me learn how to write pencil and ink and the art of storytelling in this medium. So it's nice to see Hillary, still drumming up time to do these things because he doesn't get paid for them. You know, Fear Agent's just it's all love. And I recognize that, we've always sold between 5,000 and 10,000 copies of the singles. And it's not a huge audience. It's enough to keep the thing going in one way or another, but we've all, unfortunately, its shipping schedule has always suffered. But I look at it more like I don't do comics for anyone else. I do them because I have to do them. I do them just because I have to. I had to do Fear Agent, just had to. And Strange Girl as well had a regular readership of about 4,000 or 5,000. And we kept that going to the end. It's just because I have to. Once I start telling one of these stories, I get so invested and involved and in love with the characters. So getting to tell the full story of Heath, even though the shipping schedule has been broken, and get to do it with Mike Hawthorne and Tony Moore and John Lucas sort of tag-teaming the art to where it looks, I think, better than anything. I mean, I don't know. Jerome's fourth volume was pretty much amazing as hell.
Sure.
The point is, and I'm meandering here, the point is about it is that it's been a labor of love. And artistically, not one page of the book has ever gone to print without everybody poring over it and making sure that it was the best foot forward. And so when it's all said and done, its shipping schedule hurt the sales, I think. And I think that everybody looking at numbers has kind of learned that if you're not shipping monthly, your numbers can't maintain and grow. They just can't. It just doesn't happen. And so in terms of taking a financial hit, and in terms of taking a hit in terms of, you know, the book's visibility because of the poor shipping schedule, now that it's over, I'm okay with that. You know, there was a time there that it was difficult for me because the book was my baby, and still really is. And now that it's done and I can look back, I can, like, as I'm doing these last issues, I'm rereading the first five volumes over and over and making sure that I didn't miss anything in my outlining for the ending and
Cool. Make
sure that it's all covered. And I just can't believe how Jerome Apena and Tony Moore have just made that book a love letter. It is just so gorgeous. And Mike Hawthorne has been involved in helping Tony with issues going back all the way to the third volume.
Yes.
Or the first volume, even, I think, he was helping Tony out. So Mike has had a hand in the book from the very beginning, and John Lucas as well. It wasn't just going to be breakdown credit. Like, Mike is doing much more than that. He's doing very tight, rough pencils. And then Tony is going in and doing all the faces and inking them, and then John Lucas is doing finishes on the rest of it and matching it up with Tony's work. So the last arc looks as good, if not better, than any of the preceding arcs. And you know, Mike Hawthorne is just one of the, if not the, he's just an amazing storyteller. I couldn't be happier with the end result.
Well, I it's funny, and you know this with a lot of our podcasting friends. We all love Fear Agent, and really, I can't think of a podcast of the big ones that doesn't love Fear Agent. I have a feeling that whenever it happens, I think an audience will eventually find this book, and the great thing is they're going to find, you know, six great volumes. Is it more than six? How many volumes is it?
It'll be six when it's done,
right.
And then there'll be two Tales of the Fear Agent Trades collecting all the short stories.
There you go. And, I mean, that's the thing, this giant body of work that I think down the line, it won't surprise me that, you know, in the teens or something like that, whenever the eventual Fear Agent movie comes out, someone will find a reason for there to be more Fear Agent stories. I am firmly convinced of that.
So I appreciate that, John. It means, you guys and around comics and iFanboy, everybody, it means a lot. You know, you do feel like you're working in a vacuum sometimes. And, you know, while Fear Agent did launch our careers in a lot of ways, you know, like obviously Tony had the huge head of the hit of The Walking Dead.
Certainly.
In terms of Jerome and I especially, I think the Fear Agent had a lot to do with, you know, our getting noticed and finding other work and, you know, building our career at Marvel. The years that you spend working on those projects and without hearing any feedback except for the occasional three or four letters an issue you'll get, it's disheartening. You have to really be doing it for yourself. That said, it's always been really nice to hear, you know, when smart people like you and the guys at iFanboy and around comics and the various other podcasts who have been really generous to us say nice things and take the time to pay attention to it, because we've just killed ourselves on every issue. It gets so much time. And now I'm ruined. Now my schedule is ruined, because now I do that on like everything I'm doing at Marvel. Like I'm like, I have to make this, you know, as good or better. And I guess it's not a bad instinct. I'm not going to be the fastest guy in the world because of it. But those books get seen. Punisher and X-Force will be read by a lot of people. And it turns out Marvel comic books get, you know, sell for a long time and people dig them. So I am kind of hoping that what Jerome and I are doing and what Tony and I are doing at Marvel lead some people back to Fear Agent. And I hope you're right. I hope that, you know, if the film, there's big stuff happening. I never really, you know, believe any of it.
Understood.
But if it does happen and we get that kind of a bump and see that the tremendous success that, you know, something like The Walking Dead has seen, or even, I don't even need that, you know, that's lightning in a bottle. If the thing just had a life and some longevity where I think at this point, each one of the trades sells like 100 and 150 copies a month.
That's terrific.
Yeah, and you know what? 150 copies going out every month of all five of the volumes. I'm pretty okay with that. You know,
sure.
It would be great if it was more. And if we get the omnibus out next summer and the thing slowly builds and the movie does happen and people find it, that would be terrific. But I can honestly say that from all of us who have worked on it and poured so much into it, if it doesn't, I think we'll be okay. You know, I think it'll just be something that we can all hold and high-five each other and be like, look at this fucking thing we made.
But just like, an age earlier when The Rocketeer kind of showed up and filled that need of people that loved the old sci-fi cliffhangers of the 30s and stuff like that.
Right.
I mean, that's the thing. I mean, I really think that there will always be that one segment of, you know, I hate the word, but the geek fandom that loves that kind of science fiction, and then the 50s kind of science fiction, and that's what, you know, obviously Fear Agent answers to and is well represented in the genre. I mean, it's a great new, fresh take that people can look at and say, okay, that, you know, if you liked the Mac Ray Boy Flash Gordon, or if you liked, you know, that Wally Wood, you know, style and stuff, this is something new that you will absolutely appreciate. As you say, the art is just spot on, and the stories are fantastic. So, because there's always attempts at doing this stuff, and sometimes they're just half-assed.
Sure.
They really are, and that's why they don't last more than a couple. Right, and that's why they only last a couple issues and stuff
right.
like that. And,
yeah.
and you know, so we appreciate the time that you guys put in and the effort. And again, there's going to be a nice body of work that people will be able to grab and say, oh, okay, cool. It wasn't just happening in the 50s. It did happen beyond that.
Well, I thank you for that, John. It means a lot to me. And, you know, it's crazy. You had mentioned The Rocketeer because The Rocketeer was such a motivator and Fear Agent for me. I collected. I still have all of the, you know, the singles and the various one shots where, you know, Dave would do 8 pages that you're just like, holy shit! How was this buried in, what was the company, Pacifica?
Or yes, right? I want to say Pacific Comics, wasn't it?
Oh man, it was a couple.
It jumped around
for a while there. I managed a comic shop. Random boxes would come in. I'd be like, there's a Rocketeer story in there, and I haven't seen it. And what?
Well, and we were those kids that were coming in every week bugging the store owners, too, and saying, any news on The Rocketeer?
Yeah.
I know it's been 8 months, but really, anything?
Right.
No,
yeah,
sorry, man.
That was the quality, the inherent, the high quality and the level of craftsmanship in that book. It was important to us to leave something behind that felt like that. And that was the initial conversation Tony Moore and I had when we were cooking it up. And then when Jerome came on, and you know, Jerome was on it by issue 4, you know, helping out,
mm-hmm.
And you know, we made sure to give him some stake in it, not just like a page rate, but hey, you know, you're in, man, you're part of the team, that investment, you know, helps people do their best work, and you know, Jerome did the same thing. You can watch Jerome grow into the motherfucker he is now. Like in 2 volumes of Fear Agent, you know, that took him 2 years because he was doing about a trade a year at that point because we're spending so much time on it. You can see Jerome page by page, and literally as I'm reading it, I'm like, oh, look at Jerome learned. Oh my God. Oh wow. Oh shit. Oh God. Look at Jerome. you know, I was thinking one day I would put together everything Jerome and I have done from 2005 until now, and then like a flip book and flip through it and watch Jerome become the world's greatest comic book artist.
Before we wrap up, I also wanted to mention what's going on at Radical, Last Days of American Crime. That was an excellent finish, and I enjoyed every issue. I thought the format was very satisfying, and that's a very, very cool book, and I understand the trade is coming out soon.
Yeah, trade is shipping on November 17th, and I couldn't be more proud of it. You know, that was another thing where it was just, you know, a labor of love. And Greg Tocchini, again, no exaggeration, the guy was spending like 4 or 5 days on a page. It's just bleeding with the guy's life. And I wrote the screenplay for the film adaptation and rewrote that 7 or 8 times, and by the time I got into the comic book and was writing that, I knew the story frontwards and back, and hopefully that it feels concise and quick and fat-free, because there's nothing better than having that opportunity to sort of tear something open and rewrite it that many times and take out what you perceive to be any fat.
And if I remember correctly, Sam Worthington doing the movie?
Yeah, playing Kevin. That is
fantastic.
Where things are at right now, and then can't talk about any of the other stuff that's happening. But hopefully, there'll be some news soon.
Very cool. And I honestly, I really love the format. I like the way it's set up for Time Bomb as well, another graphic novel series that Radical is doing. And yeah. I think it was, especially, God, for, you know, was it $4.99 per issue?
Yeah, you know. You
hell of a value.
50 pages of prestige material for $4.99 and a square bound. And then, you know, the trade's 150 pages for $15, I think.
Fantastic.
Yeah, and I couldn't be more proud of it. I think that it's a nice representation of you know what I would consider to be some of my best work. So if anybody hasn't tried my creator-owned, and I think you can pick yourself up one of their trade paperbacks, and it's pretty good.
Yeah, I would say for Punisher fans that want to see more of Rick's crime work and everything, this is a great example. I imagine that all of the Maleev covers will be in the trade.
Yes. Yeah, all of Maleev's covers and Tokini's as well.
Cool.
Very, very. It's a beautiful bundle of paper.
It really is. It absolutely is. So no, we'll look for that this week. Very, very nice. Yeah. In fact, as we'll record, or I should say that when you're hearing this, folks, you'll know that it's on the newsstands this week. So make sure you pick it up.
Make sure you pick it up.
Now, what about your stuff in terms of? When you started with Marvel a couple of years ago to where you are now, do you feel like, you know, there's been progression? I mean, is there anything you are doing now that you struggled with when you first joined Marvel in any way? Is there a rhythm to it?
I live in a world of self-doubt. Like, I'm a fraud. I don't know if you know that about me or not, but I know it. Like, if I know one thing for sure, I am definitely a fraud. And, I think I tend to, like, you know, the people would say, like, as in terms of finding my footing or what I'm doing at Marvel, around the time I got my exclusive, I had my first kid, and, we've got the second on the way now, and that really changes your priorities. You can't be, like, fuck the world, I'm doing a punk rock comic for 2 years, you know, like, that's not happening anymore. I can't afford to do that. I have, I have mouths to feed and a mortgage. And I think that there was a period there where, when I first went into Marvel, that I was a little defensive about the idea of it. And I on one hand, wanted so bad to knock everything out of the park that I touched there. And on the other hand, wanted to continue to do sort of obscure things. And those kind of don't go hand in hand in terms of sales. And so I think that the self-doubt, when something like Dr. Voodoo didn't succeed in terms of money, and everybody was like, oh, I love this, it seemed to critically be well received.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean anything.
Right. No, I understand.
This is a cash dollar business, baby. And I take those things pretty hard, like that sends me on a spiral for a while that always comes back to I'm no good. Oh shit, you know what happened? Everybody finally figured it out.
No.
Well, but I
understand though.
It's just part of the
sure.
It's just the nature of the beast in terms of a lot of, artistic, anyway. So being in a position where that could have led me to one of two conclusions with my work at Marvel. One, be safe. And give them, nothing that's going to shock anyone or do anything different. And you've got a kid now, and make sure you don't cause any waves in terms of what you do. Or B, remember what you love and how many years you spent to get here. And Marvel hired you for a reason, and it wasn't to water yourself down.
Absolutely.
And the fear level of doing Frankencastle, the fear that like, Axel loves it, Tony loves it. We're excited as shit. We're yelling on the phone, and then the fucking man thing shows up, and everybody's yelling, and it's like, woo! But I know for a fact that everybody's going to say, so yeah, it's like that time Punisher was the angel. And you're like, no, it's not. It's totally different. It's way cooler, and Tony Moore's going to draw the shit out of it. But that you're going to take it on the chin for some fans who don't like anything to change.
Right.
They know this is a Punisher story. I want him... I want a crack addict with a gun in his mouth. I want him mowing down, like, take that, Mexican, pop, pop, pop. Don't you? It's.
You're right though. No, it's why they want Wile E. Coyote. They want the Roadrunner.
Yeah, and hey, I'm not
nothing
disparaging
wrong with
that, but I am saying, like, in terms of where I was at in the story, that was a big risk. So the long and short of my meandering here is, for where I'm at now, I feel good about the risks that I've taken and the quality, because, you know, when you do something like Frankencastle, it is a chance and it is a risk, and we knew it needed to be A-plus on everybody's performance level. And we all just dumped our lives into it. And while the people who love it, like, love it. The people who love it, like, love it.
Yes.
And that's, my wife, I remember she said something to me when I was considering, like, you know, like, instead of shooting for books like Dr. Voodoo, I should really just be shooting for bigger, more mainstream characters, because we have a family, you know. The reality is I have a family to support. And she said something along the lines of, like, all of your favorite bands, like, pick your 20 favorite bands and tell me how many of them do you think, like, made a lot of money. And the reality of it when I went through was not many of them. Like, when I went through all the things that speak to me and get me tingly and excited about living, the art that speaks to my soul, most of that stuff isn't, like, you know, never made it to the top 100 of any chart. It didn't, you know, it was never pushed by EMI. It was never, there was never, you know, pyrotechnics blowing up and blowjobs at the backstage. It just wasn't the stuff that spoke to me. And it was important for me to find a way to be able to do this work, make Marvel happy, and keep myself happy. And I feel like for the first time in the last couple months, like, I might be on my footing with that. Like,
okay.
I feel like I might be. I feel good about what I've done. And with the books I have coming up, it's a nice middle. They're big characters that people love and have big audiences. But their characters and takes on the characters that I'm very genuinely incredibly excited about, that speak to my sensibility and feel like this is why I work so hard, and I'm not doing something, like, I'll be honest, like The Atom. I didn't, you know, The Atom could have been great, but for a lot of reasons it wasn't. I don't feel now how I felt doing The Atom.
Well, but Rick, you also came in on a lot of those situations kind of, and it's funny, while we're recording today, and I think we both acknowledged it and are thrilled for Phil Hester jumping in on Wonder Woman, as yeah. he's doing for JMS and everything like that. It was an emergency call. The deadline right. was already there. Phil, right. we need you to take it to the hole. And I really felt in a lot of your DC work, that's what was going on.
Right.
So you really weren't given the chance, and I think The Atom was the closest you did have, where you were able to set up a few things and have a semblance of a story. But again, I think deadlines and walking into a burning building were a couple strikes against
sure,
you.
Of course.
And
yeah,
I really think in the case of Marvel, I would say trust your instincts. They did hire you to be you, and, you know, the good thing is you are being given the chance with a lot of these books to start with an issue one. In the case of Dr. Voodoo, that, you know,
it's hard, though.
Right, well, but now beyond that, and I'm not faulting publishing for this, but obviously the cutoff line at Marvel is very specific. I don't know what that number is, and it literally, I mean, I've seen it. Yours is not the only good book that suffered from that. It happened to Parker and Hardman on Atlas. I mean, that's a perfect example of another really great idea that, for whatever reasons, and it doesn't help when you're competing with your own company for shelf
right.
space and events and everything else that's going on.
Know.
So I'm, you know, it's funny. We'll see what happens. I think the economy, you know, dictated a lot of these cutoffs as well, and I can appreciate that. But I also think that it'll be interesting watching both DC and Marvel next year and years ahead with the kind of wake-up call that I think the economy has caused, and
yeah.
that they're going to have to be very careful with what's, you know, books they put out. And that's why even with the Legions of Monsters thing, I'm like, well, yeah, maybe it's a miniseries. Maybe
right.
that is the way to look at it, unfortunately.
It would be the only way. I don't think it could support, you know, until I write a crossover, until I'm the guy who writes the crossover event, and
right.
I get to put them in the center of it and go, you know who saves the day? The fucking Legion of Monsters. Nobody's expecting them to ride in. But when they do, everybody would have a giant boner, because it would be so awesome. To
Yay, Morbius!
But, yeah, right. Yeah, here comes, yeah. Fucking Morbius saved the day. He's, you know, coming in with Frankenstein, batting people around, and Manphibian pops out of the ocean with an army of Manphibians, and woo!
And even Jack Russell.
And the Werewolf by Night cutting dudes up and acting all mean. Until that happens, no ongoing could survive.
Understood,
it's
man.
The eyes, you have to turn eyes to the things and then go, look how awesome they are, in such a big way to make a new idea sell. And it's like the curse of the industry. And everybody says, well, Marvel doesn't try new things. Marvel totally tries
sure,
new
they
things.
Do. No, they do.
Marvel
they do.
Does try but, new but, things. But nobody buys new shit that they try a lot of the time. And, you know.
Well, but yeah, that's kind of, again, and this is my own editorial. It's you don't feel the need to join me in the chorus. But I said it to Bendis about Alias. I don't think Jessica Jones' Alias book would have survived in the current atmosphere. I don't.
No.
I really don't.
No, nothing against Brian, obviously. No, I mean,
come on, everybody loves Alias. We all love Alias, and it was a nice long burn, and again, it was a different time, and the opportunity was there because the numbers were so low that a book selling, 15,000 was a triumph, I think, in 2001 or whenever it was that Alias was getting started.
Right.
So, I mean, I understand. I totally, and I don't know what the numbers are, so Brian, if you're listening, sorry.
Well, I might not even be right because I think Scarlet's selling 15 or 20 right now, and in this market, that's still really good.
Well, but that's an Icon book, and again, that's a different.
Oh, right.
There's
right.
There's a different rule for Icon than I think there is for Alias and things that were being put out by Marvel. Book of Souls, JMS book, JMS
right.
Carleen Doran, excellent team, as close to Vertigo Magic as Marvel I think's gotten in the last 10 years. Failed, okay, and it failed from a sales standpoint, but it was an interesting book.
Yeah, I think that there's a lot to be said for not, I think that based on the economy, that stuff will probably be getting cooled out for a while, and this is, I don't have any knowledge about that.
Of course,
again,
oh no.
Sort of speaking as a fan. It's unfortunately up to the private sector in terms of comics, and that's the creator-owned guys, to really try new things and innovate. And in a way where they're taking, it's a 28-year-old guy who can live on mac and cheese while he tries something new and crazy.
Yep.
And hopefully that keeps happening, and that's normally where that stuff comes from. And what we have to do now is we have to make the characters that the people have made it clear they do care about, we have to make them sharp, and we have to make them shine, and we have to make them smart, and we have to make things better than they've ever been. That's the only, when we talk about, somebody was talking about, we need bigger things or something. I don't know. I had so many conversations in the last 2 weeks. It's not. We need to now be escalating things quality-wise, and that's all. Whatever your idea is, whatever your log line, whatever your high concept, it just needs to be better. In terms of just the amount of time you put into your structure, your beats, your reveals, your character arcs, the humanity that you put into your characters, the shit you drag them through that you just make readers itch to see them climb back up and get their and save the day or whatever it is. I think that the only way for these things to work, given that this is where we're at right now, is for us all at Marvel in terms of, I always forget, I'm like, oh yeah, I'm one of those guys. But that was sort of a lot of the conversation on X-Force. Well, it's a big team of, really cool X-Men characters, and Apocalypse is a big villain. But when Jerome and I would get on the phone, it was like, all we have to do is not worry about anything but making this our absolute very best foot forward. And to that end, putting in 3-4, times the amount of time that you're normally allotted for this sort of thing. And Marvel's been great. We've been working on X-Force since, February of last year. We've been working on it forever.
Wow.
Jerome's about done with issue 4 right now.
Oh, terrific.
But he's been spending, a week on he just turned in a double-page spread that he spent a week on. And I just hope that, I think that that's the only way to step it up. Take the characters that people have made their minds up that they do want to read about and make sure that there's not, there's not one thing that goes out with your name on it that isn't your best foot forward.
Will he alternate with another artist for subsequent issues, or is...
Esad.
Ah, okay, good. Oh, wonderful.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Esad Ribic, Shazam!
Hell yeah. Well, and didn't he work with you on Punisher as well, right?
Did Esad work with me? No.
No?
Well, he did the last sequential stuff he did was Wolverine the List with Jason Aaron.
Okay, yes, and I do remember reading that, but I thought he had worked with you before, specifically.
No, he's been doing covers on X-Force. He's the cover artist.
Oh, okay, okay.
And he's going to keep doing covers. When you see the cover for issue 5 and we announce the protagonist of our next arc and you see what he's done with this cover, oh boy, he is amazing.
So will the roster rotate then? When you say
Jerome, the thing that Jerome's going to be working on, because again, now Jerome is a crazy person. Now Jerome spends 4 days on a page.
Right.
So Jerome, and you know, that's a hit. What people don't recognize is that that makes Jerome make a lot less money.
Of course.
And you know, as it did on Fear Agent and all these things, it's just a matter of, like, we love doing this and want to be really good at it. And so in terms of when Jerome comes back on the book, that is going to be a big, 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 big event we're building up to in X-Force. And Jerome will be – he'll have plenty of time. We're getting him started. As soon as he's done with issue 4, I think he's going to get started on that third arc, and it's going to be it's a big love letter to a lot of things I really dig about the X-Men.
But to clarify, you said the protagonist will change in the second arc?
Did I say protagonist?
Yes.
I meant antagonist.
Oh, okay. That's fine, too. That's why I'm like, oh, so this isn't the regular rotation. There are going to be different.
Yeah.
Always, okay.
No, we've got two new members that join up in the course of the second and third arc, but then it's capped.
Okay. Okay, because I was going to say, it did seem like a pretty lean team, being only you know, 4 members or 5 members.
It's nice. It's nice, and this when it's 7, it'll work. I mean, at this point, it gives me time to take the 5 and really flesh them out and establish their dynamics before the others come in, and then I can get their dynamics going and then kill them all.
Well, and as unfortunately, again, as a person who, you know, is always like, there's too many goddamn X-Men, I'm all for a smaller team. That's fine. So, you know, that's okay. Even when Cornell was writing that Dark X-Men story and stuff, I'm like, oh, good, you got like 4 characters. That's fine. Perfect.
Yeah.
That's all I want.
It's
more than enough mutants for my taste. That's all right.
Yeah, the only way Chris Claremont dealt with that huge cast was, you know, I've been rereading a lot of that stuff, was he had a lot of 8-panel pages and a lot of text. That stuff was and it's great, you know, like it's terrific and imaginative, and the characters all have their distinct voices and stuff. But I don't want to have to compress things to that level.
Understood. Well, as you say, all you have to worry about is making good comics. You're doing it with both books right now. I really enjoyed both first issues. X-Force, like I said, the stuff I didn't understand, I appreciate you explaining, but it's a beautiful book. Hitting the needs of the X people because it sold out so well. So continued success with that. That Punisher story, where I am more comfortable and I know what the hell is going on, I'm enjoying it and really looking forward to the wrap up on that. And of course, Fear Agent is just wonderful.
Oh,
so, so keep it up, man. And as always, thanks for checking in, and we'll bug you in a few months to talk about whatever you want.
Yeah, for sure. It was good talking with you. Thank you.
That's Rick Remender. Make sure you check out Uncanny X-Force. Rick is wrapping up his runs on Fear Agent and his run on Punisher. John Sutra saying thanks again for listening to Word Balloon. Today it's brought to you by InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com, where as always you get a wide selection of trade paperbacks, hardbacks, essentials, absolute editions, omnibus editions, and more, with discounts of 38 to 42% off the standard retail price. And Rick Remender is well represented at InStockTrades.com. You may want to spend a lot of money. In fact, as always at InStockTrades.com, when you spend $50 or more, you get free shipping. Lots of great product at InStockTrades.com with the name Rick Remender on it, including his Fear Agent books. We talk about Fear Agent. It's wrapping up. And you can catch up with Fear Agent at 42% off the standard retail price when you buy trades at InStockTrades.com. Volume 2 of Fear Agent, My War, the standard retail price is $14.95. It's just $8.67 at InStockTrades.com. Same with the last Fear Agent arc, Eye Against Eye. The standard retail price is $14.95, $8.67 at InStockTrades.com. If you didn't have the chance to read Rick's Dr. Voodoo, the trade paperback is available. The standard retail price, $16.99. InStockTrades.com has it for $10.53. You'll find tons of Rick's Punisher work as well from Marvel at InStockTrades.com. Again, with 38% off the standard retail price. For all the details, check out their website, InStockTrades.com.
Thanks again for listening to Word Balloon today. Great episodes coming up throughout the holiday season. This is Thanksgiving week. Everyone in America, have a wonderful Thanksgiving. And around the world, America's Thanksgiving is our time when we think about family and friends. So even if you're not celebrating Thanksgiving, take a moment, thank your friends and family for what they mean to your life. And thank you, Word Balloon friends, for being a part of my life and making this show possible and entertaining for me and something I look forward to doing every week. Follow us here online at our website, wordballoon.com, and, of course, at iFanboy every Tuesday with a new Word Balloon episode. We're at iTunes. Make sure you subscribe to the feed. Please review us and write a rating if you don't mind. We sure would appreciate it. Questions or comments about the show, you can reach me via email, john@wordballoon.com. Follow me on Twitter under John Word Balloon, or, of course, my Facebook page under my name, John Suntress. Until next time, Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2010.